So the paper deals, half of it deals with prayer. The other half is introducing a figure who I'm looking at. This is part of a larger project I've been working on for a few years, which is a history of prayer among Baptists, among Calvinistic Baptists, beginning in the 17th century, probably ending in my own thinking about the time of Spurgeon. And I had hoped to do something more thematic, but I'm not far enough along to think in those terms. So it's a focused paper dealing with a man named Benjamin Francis, who was, as we will see, a Welshman who eventually became very proficient in English and had a ministry in England in the southwest Cotswolds in Gloucestershire, not far from the Welsh border. That's a picture of him, at least it was a print of him. How good a copy it is, I have no idea. But interesting print there. It shows him wearing a typical clergyman's bands, you know, eventually will morph into the, what we call the dog, at least I call it the dog collar. I'm sure there is something about some technical name for that I'm not aware of, but it is interesting that a number of Baptist ministers in the 18th century would have worn such. About a year and a half before the voluminous English Baptist divine John Gill, that probably needs no introduction, the most important Baptist theologian between the 1720s and his death in 1771. But a year before he died, he considered the possibility of stepping down from his Southwark pastorate where he had been since 1719. Actually, somebody had proposed to him the idea of an assistant pastor. And the story goes that his response was, I've gone through the scriptures, I can find no such creature. he probably did need one, but anyway. A number of his congregation were eager for him to have an assistant, since he was evidently failing physically. Gill, though, was willing to consider complete retirement if one condition were met, namely the Welsh Baptist by the name of Benjamin Francis, pastor of the work at Horsley, Gloucestershire, could be persuaded to succeed him. Nothing seems to have come of Gill's suggestion during his lifetime. After his death, though, the first man they asked to fill the pulpit a long term to become the pastor was Francis. And he was invited to preach at the church, and by February 1772, the deacons of the church had made a point of approaching Francis about the possibility of his moving to London. Francis wrote to his fellow Welshman, Caleb Evans, tutor of the Bristol Baptist Academy, about his astonishment at the request. My dear friend, I cannot express the astonishment, the shame, the concern and perplexity my mind has been overwhelmed with ever since. The thought of parting with my dear people and of the unhappy consequences that may follow dissolves my heart and almost overpowers my spirits. While on the other hand, a pleasing prospect of more extensive general usefulness presents itself. I am in a great strait. My mind is in a state of perpetual suspense. And those of you who are pastors, I'm sure, can very well identify with both of those feelings. You know, he had spent, at this point, over 20 years at the church. He had seen it grow significantly. He had built his life into the lives of these people. On the other hand, London would have given him, it's the heart of the empire. It's a very, very different scenario. Urban center. He would have had a salary that he could have lived on. His great struggle through his life was his people were poor, and he never really had enough money to live on. And so you can see the sort of dilemma that he was caught in. Francis eventually decided not to go to London. And though he felt astonishment and shame at being asked to succeed Gill, it says much of the respect in which the Welsh pastor was held that he was the first pastor to be considered for the famous London Baptist pastorate. The church then asked John Fawcett, the very well-known Yorkshire Baptist. He got further along the road of accepting the pastor than Francis did, because he actually had all of his belongings packed on a wagon. And the congregation in Yorkshire came to say goodbye and were weeping. And he just couldn't leave. So he ordered them to unpack the wagon. And then he subsequently wrote that very, very famous hymn, "Blessed Be the Tie That Binds." That's the story. And there's no indication it's not true. Eventually, they called a young man named John Rippon from Devonshire, who was around 20 when they called him. And he was there for 63 years. So So, Benjamin Francis. Unknown to nearly all but a few historians today, Benjamin Francis was in many respects a remarkable individual. He was the youngest son of Enoch Francis, the most respected Welsh Baptist minister of his day, and one who was extremely gifted in winning hearers. Orphaned at the age of six, the younger Francis was later convinced that he personally experienced God's saving grace when he was but a boy. Baptized at Swansea, it's in Wales, when he was 15, Francis began to preach 4 years later. His ministry began at a time when far too many English and Welsh Baptist congregations were stymied in their growth by hyper-Calvinism or insular thinking or just plain apathy. Francis, though, went on to be trained at Bristol Baptist Academy, where a vibrant evangelical Calvinism was not only preserved, but also actively fostered. Due in part to his training at Bristol, Francis would eventually play a significant role in the renewal and revival that came to the Calvinistic Baptist cause later in the century. As Bristol Baptist Raymond Brown has noted with regard to a number of the students who studied at Bristol, many of the Bristol students brought an outstanding contribution to the life of the churches in the second half of the 18th century. Men like John Ash or Pershaw, he's probably the inventor of the dictionary, the English dictionary. Usually it's Samuel Johnson that's remembered, but Ash did one before him. Ash is also very important because he created a major hymnal that becomes used in Baptist churches. Benjamin Bedham is a very, very significant man. He was at Borden on the Water for 55 years. And Benjamin Francis and Horsley were content to serve their respective churches for between 40 and 50 years, pouring their entire working ministry into the pastoral care of rural congregations, faithful biblical preaching, the development of association life, the establishment of new causes, and in each case, the composition or publication of hymns. Their devotional hymnology, passion for associating, evangelistic initiatives helped to divert many churches from high Calvinism, that is hyper-Calvinism, and introduce them to these influences which were powerfully at work in the evangelical revival. It says a lot for the importance of theological education, it's something I think about, that these men all went to Bristol. But it also gives you some idea of the kind of the, we're not going to develop all these areas, obviously, we're really looking at prayer, but it's all these kind of areas that these men were involved in. The fact that they poured their lives into small village churches, and there's a brother over in England now, he's an American actually from the deep south, called Barry King. I don't know if you know of this man, but he's been able to revitalize probably half a dozen little churches in various parts of southern England, and was recently appealing to Baptists on this side of the Atlantic to help support the revitalization of churches in small villages. We tend to forget these works, but they're very important. The whole area of, obviously, biblical preaching, development of association life, these men were very committed to working together. The establishment of new causes, they had the vision to be thinking of, we need to plant new works, and hymnody. Hymns are we're not the first generation to go through worship wars, and hymns were a big battle in the 18th century because many churches simply sang the Psalms. And these men were convinced that hymnody was a vehicle for spiritual renewal. Francis studied at Bristol from 1753 to 1756. When he first arrived in Bristol, his knowledge of English was so slight, he could not even return thanks for his food in the language. Apparently he was asked, could you please give thanks? And he couldn't even speak enough English to say thanks for the food. The principal, Bernard Foskett, basically at that point said, you need to go back to Wales and learn some English. But there was a Welshman there, Hugh Evans. He was the father of Caleb Evans. He would eventually become the principal after Foskett. And he had been converted under the preaching of Enoch Francis. So he's been converted under the preaching of the father of this young man. And so he pleaded that Benjamin be allowed to stay. By dint of study, Francis eventually obtained a thorough knowledge of English so he could preach with complete ease in either it or Welsh. After he graduated, Francis preached for a while in Chipping Sodbury, Gloucestershire, one of these fabulous Cotswolds towns. All of them have their own unique flavor, usually architecture, color of stone, and so on. And it's actually my favorite area of England. I just absolutely love the Cotswolds. Eventually, in 1757, he moved to Horsley, That's it, still in Gloucestershire, where the following year he was ordained at the age of 24. Although the church there consisted of 66 members, most of them were poor artisans, cloth workers, and unable to provide financially for his support. Francis once described the circumstances of most of the congregation as being extremely indigent. That is, very poor. And near the end of his life, he remarked that his congregation was, for the most part, poor, plain, and have not had the advantage of literature. That means they've not had any education. And thus he was obliged, he had to do a variety of things to make ends meet. He was obliged to rear pigs. He started his own little farm. That never really went well. Grow his own fruit and vegetables. He tried keeping a school. He tried to be a schoolmaster. That didn't go well. He tried to have a business, the woolen trade. He lost money on that. And he was really like Jonathan Edwards, who, when he had to leave Northampton, said, I'm really only fitted for the pastorate and the study. And that's what God had called him to. But the problem, the challenge of being bivocational, was just a wear and tear on him all through his life. Alongside these monetary problems, Francis also experienced a long series of domestic trials. In 1765, his first wife and three of their children all died within the space of 3 months. He married again a year later to an Abigail Wallace. They had 10 children, of whom they buried 7. In the midst of these deeply distressing circumstances, Francis drew comfort from the piety that a number of his dying children exhibited. For instance, when one of the children from his second marriage, Hester, was dying at the age of 11 in August 1790, she told her mother, "My soul is as full of joy as it can contain. The Lord is become my salvation. The gates of heaven are open to me, and I shall soon be there." Her last words to her father were, "I love you, but I love Christ more." And if you notice the footnote there, that's an obituary that he actually wrote about his daughter's death. Despite these deep trials, Francis proved to be a tireless evangelist, one we are told who delighted in telling poor sinners the unsearchable riches of his compassionate Redeemer. I realized after I'd gotten everything printed, I'd missed out a long quote about his a typical week. And just reading it makes you feel tired. And he would spend the weekend at his church, and then he'd basically begin a process of itinerant preaching, ranging probably 50, 60 miles around Horsley, preaching in all kinds of villages. And it's an absolutely remarkable ministry that he had. During his time at Horsley, Francis baptized nearly 450 persons who had been converted under his ministry. At the time of his death, the number of members in his church was 252. Probably is a lot larger. To be baptized in those days in England was a scandalous act. And so a lot of people were quite pleased to come and hear him preach, but never joined the church because that would have required believer's baptism. The meeting house was enlarged 3 times during his ministry. So by the early 19th century, the church was one of the largest in the British Calvinistic Baptist community. It's noteworthy that Francis attributed much of the success of attendance preaching to the Sunday prayer meetings the church held at 6 o'clock in the morning. They would have a prayer meeting before the worship service, and then they'd have one in the afternoon, before the afternoon service. They didn't have an evening service because of lighting issues. You'd have to have used candles, which would have been very expensive. So they'd probably begin worship around 9 or 10, about two and a half hours. Then they'd have lunch together. And then obviously they had a prayer meeting again, and then the afternoon service. For some people, this would mean they'd have to have been up at 3 in the morning. They'd walk 2 or 3 hours to get there. They'd stay at the church all day, and then they're walking home. It'd be in the dark. 50 or 60 would come to the Sunday morning prayer meeting. While at the afternoon prayer meeting, the vestry would literally overflow with people. I'm not sure how many that would mean. We're just told the place was filled with those who would be praying for the ministry that afternoon. We have none of his sermons. Little remains of his extensive preaching ministry by way of literary text. We do have some of his poems, including a variety of polemical pieces, and you can see the footnotes, what we have. A number of elegies. Those are poems you write when in honor and celebration of a person after their death. We have one for John Gill, George Whitfield. That tells you a lot. Interesting. Usually those two men don't go together. But Francis loved them both. And Samuel Pierce, who some of you may know is one of my heroes. There's also a 2-volume collection of his hymns in Welsh called Alleluia. Virtually none of them being translated into English. And so it's very disappointing. We have very little literary text. And none of his sermons, we don't have one of them that has survived. He may not have written out a manuscript. I'm not sure about this. In which case, it's going to be very difficult. Describing his preaching, his son-in-law, Flint, a man named Flint, emphasizes that Franz was always concerned to declare the whole counsel of God. Firm in expressing his doctrinal convictions, he was also a compassionate preacher who often openly wept for his hearers. To some degree, this is 18th century. There is actually a change that I think it's documentary. It can be documented that men go through in the 19th century, these British men, where the whole idea of the stiff upper lip and men don't cry becomes part and parcel. Because in the 18th century, you know, guys like Whitfield weeping, but you have others. And men were more ready to cry publicly. Growing up in Britain, this is something you'd associate with, you know, the Southern Europeans. You know, they're more emotional. But it would seem that there's something happens in that Victorian era over a number of generations. Possibly the closest we get to hearing his melodious voice, that's the way one person described it, is in the circular letters he drew up for the Western Association of Calvinistic Baptist Churches. Associations of churches in geographical proximity had been a regular feature of Calvinistic Baptist life since the denomination's 17th century beginnings. By the last half of the 18th century, these associations were holding annual meetings. Please note, this is not a denomination. There's no sort of denominational structure until the 19th century. But what spurred their growth were these local associations, usually 20, 30 churches, in a fairly close geographical area that it was conceivable for their members to meet annually once a year, all of them, as well as the pastors maybe four or five times a year. And that's at the heart of Baptist life, I think. Not so much sometimes the larger associations, denominations. By the last half of the 18th century, these associations were holding annual meetings at which representatives of the churches in these associations, usually the pastors and elders, were meeting for a couple of days. And there'd also be other, the members would come together. So William Cooper, for instance, the hymn writer, tells us of meetings that took place in his backyard because if you've ever been to Olney, he's got his house, which is now a museum, and you go down the little backyard, and there was a hut back there where he and John Newton used to smoke pipes together and write their hymns. And then beyond that was a huge field that could house about 3,000 people. And sometimes the Baptists would come to Olney and have these huge meetings. So they're large meetings, not just pastors and elders, but maybe members as well. And they'd meet for 2 or 3 days. These annual meetings would be marked by times of corporate prayer, fellowship, occasions for the public preaching of Scripture. One of Francis's poems, entitled The Association, sought to capture the ideals that informed these yearly gatherings. And this is very 18th century. So, the blessed assembly, emblem of the throng that praised the Lamb in one harmonious song. On Zion's hills where joy's celestial flow, the countless throng redeemed from sin and woe. The blessed assembly have I oft surveyed, with sweet complacence, charmingly arrayed, in robes of truth, of sanctity and love, resembling saints and seraphim above. The sacred page thy only rule and guide, thus saith the Lord, shall thy debates decide, while charity wide spreads her balmy wings o'er different notions in indifferent things, and graceful order walking hand in hand with cheerful freedom leads her willing band. In thee, the guardians of the church's weal, that's blessing and welfare, whose bosoms glow with unabating zeal, with balmy counsel their disorders heal, and truth and love and purity promote, among the sheep Emmanuel's blood has bought. In thee, impartial discipline maintains harmonious order, but aloud disclaims all human force to rule the mind, impose opinions, and the conscience bind. That's tremendous. And he's captured in those lines very much about what Baptists are about. This is an idealistic rendition, yet it enables us to see what one 18th century Baptist regarded as important about these annual assemblies. For Francis, there were times when sage advice could be sought and given, when God's people could be free to discuss in love and without rancor non-essential issues on which they disagreed, and when the sole binding force in the conscience was Scripture alone. Most significantly, Francis saw in these gatherings a visible token, in his words, an emblem of the unity and joy that fills the saints in heaven as they worship Christ the Lamb. Each of the churches in the association was supposed to send a letter to the annual meeting, informing their sister congregations of their state, newsworthy items, and prayer concerns. And at some point in the two-day meeting, one of the pastors will be chosen to write a letter to all of the churches in the association on behalf of the association itself. It will be ratified, printed after the annual meeting, and sent out as a circular letter. The Western Association, which had existed since 1653, gave Francis the privilege of writing this letter five times, in 1765, 1772, 1778, 1782, and 1796. Understandably, he touches on a number of themes in these letters: the challenges of poverty and affluence, the dangers of dead orthodoxy, faith, assurance, the need for hard religion, the disciplines of the Christian life, the unity of the local church. But there's one theme that comes up again and again: the beauty of Christ and the passion that should be ours in serving him. In the final analysis, it was this passion for Christ and his glory that underlay all of Francis's evangelistic and pastoral labors. So this is an introduction. This, I think, the reason I've gone into this is it gives you an idea of where his heart lay before we look at the whole area of prayer. In the circular letter of 1772, Francis encourages those of his readers, quote, who are sickly and feeble in the spiritual life, end of quote, and who have become almost strangers to closet devotion, deep contrition for sin, earnest wrestling with the Lord in prayer, heavenly affections, and sensible communion with God, to ask themselves, will you call this the religion of Jesus? Is this the fruit of his love and crucifixion? Without a living faith in Jesus Christ, Francis reminds them, our orthodox notions, church attendance, outward morality, I'm not sure what that urges is there, that should be not there. Outward morality will ultimately avail for nothing. He thus urges upon them their need to have a spiritual sight of the awful perfections of God, of the adorable glories of Christ, and of the ineffable excellency of divine and eternal things. Moreover, they need to be aware of resting their salvation in their performance as Christians and their faithful attendance upon the various ordinances of the Christian life. Constantly rest in Christ alone, Francis says, making use of one of those central watchwords of the Reformation. And so, quote, look for every blessing in and through him, the infinitely prevalent mediator. Building on this last point, Francis urges his readers, quote, to live daily on Christ as your spiritual food, and seek hourly communion with him as the beloved of your souls. Now, one of the things I think we sometimes forget when we read these sort of documents is that most of the people hearing and reading these were not ministers. They didn't. They had to be out in the fields working, etc. And it bears remembering his counsel has been given to laborers and shopkeepers and croppers and weavers who spent most of their time simply, and I love this phrase, getting by. Their lives were difficult lives, more difficult in some ways than ours are today. And 12, 14-hour days would not be unusual in the summer for these people. And yet, notice he rightly felt they were capable of living out their daily lives as the sincere disciples and intimate friends of Jesus. And so whatever their work situation, he felt that they could put into practice what he's telling them. I think one of the dangers sometimes is you read this literature and you think, well, this really demands some sort of kind of monastic life. But that's not what he's expecting. He's expecting that they can live in the context of their work lives, a communion with Christ. In the 1778 circular letter, which is chiefly concerned with the nature of genuine vital faith, sounds similar notes. In a section of the letter dealing with the differences between assurance and faith, Francis encourages his audience, place then your entire confidence in Christ for the whole of salvation. Let the declarations and promises of the gospel be your only warrant for believing in him. And consider your purest principles, happiest frames, that is your way of thinking, but also your experience, and holiest duties, not as the foundation, but the superstructure of faith. Let not your sweetest experiences, which are the best, but shallow cisterns, but Christ alone, be the source of your comfort, and constantly live upon that inexhaustible fountain. For the believer, Christ alone is both the source of salvation and the strength for the Christian life. The final clause is, of course, an allusion to Jeremiah 2:13. There the Lord upbraids his people for forsaking him, the fountain of living waters, and living instead on the water drawn from broken cisterns of their own making. inspired no doubt by the New Testament passages such as John 4:10-13 and 7:37, where Christ states, "He is the source of living water that quenches spiritual thirst." Francis identifies the fountain of Jeremiah 2 as Christ. You see what he's doing. Now, you need to live upon Christ as the fountain of living water. And the passage, though, he's alluding to explicitly is the Jeremiah passage. But he's taking the Jeremiah passage. The fountain of living waters is the Lord Jesus. And he's doing that, I think rightly so, because Jesus himself describes himself that way in John 4 and 7. Now the whole issue of prayer. Given the nature of the piety that Francis thought of as a mark of his life, it's not surprising the Welsh pastor was also convinced of the centrality of prayer to the Christian life. An excellent window on Francis' thinking in this regard can be found in an unpublished manuscript in the archives of Bristol Baptist College, Bristol. Actually, I think the one that's there is a copy. The original is now in the National Library of Wales. And it's technically on loan there from a church called Leinster Baptist Church, which we'll talk about in just a second there. It's called Queries and Solutions. The manuscript records Francis's, it's never been published. And I have a friend who is the minister of the Countess of Huntingdon's Connection. There's only about 20 of these churches left. And it's not far from Leinster. And he went over there for some reason and found this copy. I thought there was only one in the National Library of Wales or Bristol. And he's actually transcribed the whole thing. So I now have a digital version, which I really would like to publish because it's absolutely fabulous. I'll describe it now in a second. The manuscript records Francis' precious friendship with his fellow Welshman, Joshua Thomas, who for 43 years was the pastor of the Baptist cause in Leinster. Notice that's what I'm told is the pronunciation if you're there. It's not Leominster. One of the glories of the English language is that words aren't pronounced the way they look. And I think that's glorious, but anyway. The manuscript is actually a transcript drawn up by Thomas of letters that passed between him and Francis from 1758 to 1770. The practice of Francis and Thomas appears to have been for one of them to mail two or three queries periodically to each other. So they'd mail a letter with two or three questions. Then, some months later, the recipient mailed back his answers, together with his own, with fresh questions. These answers were commented on, the new questions answered, both the comments and answers mailed back along with new queries and so forth. This is kind of their 18th century version of email. Unlike the 18th century version of email, which may not survive. This has survived because it's a hard copy. All in all, there are 68 questions and answers in two volumes, 58 in the first volume, the remaining 10 in the second volume. On only one occasion during these years from 1758 to 1770 was there a noticeable gap in correspondence. That was in 1765, and this is understandable, when Francis lost his wife and three youngest children. It's noteworthy that at the beginning of the correspondence, the two friends signed their names with simply with their names or initials. However, as time passes, this is very intriguing, their mutual confidence and intimacy deepens, and they begin to write, "Yours endearingly," or "Yours unfeignedly," or even "Yours indefatigably." That's one of those great, great names. Or "Yours inexpressibly." It was in October 1762. By the way, this is a topic for another paper, too. Men were much freer in expressing their love for each other. It's sad the day we live in that's so sexualized. Men have difficulty expressing their love for each other. It was in October 1762, Thomas first signed himself, "Your cordial brother Jonathan." His name's Joshua. This is Joshua Thomas. His name's not Jonathan. You know what he's thinking of. And the following February, Francis replied with, "Your most affectionate David." And from that point on, that's the way they talked to each other. These men would probably see each other maybe once a year. Maybe twice. The association, I think the Leinster's in the Midlands Association. I don't think it was in the same association. So they wouldn't have. I mean, you could do the trip today in an hour, but there it probably took a day or so. And so they didn't get to see each other a lot. But this was a way that they maintained this tremendous correspondence. The questions and answers are extremely instructive as to the areas of personal and theological interest among mid-18th century Calvinists. For instance, the question is asked, when may a minister conclude his influence is assisted by the Spirit of God in studying and ministering the Word? How do I know the Spirit's at work in my life? Great question. Or, queries are raised about the eternal state of dead infants. That's something we still debate. Or the millennium. It's good to know that they had questions about it like we do. This one we don't have questions about. Whether or not inoculation against that dreaded killer of the 18th century smallpox was right or wrong. We don't have questions about that. Oh, well, actually, we do. Yeah, forgive me. We do. But it's not smallpox. It's the issue of inoculation. Yeah. It's a tremendous body of just pastoral wisdom. And I'm surprised that nobody's published it before now. So I'm hoping that I can get it published because I think it's just a great body of stuff. How often should a Christian pray? Francis asked his friend on one occasion. To this very vital question posed by Francis, Thomas has an extensive answer. He deals first with what he calls ejaculatory kind of prayer. Prayers that arise spontaneously during the course of a day's activities. And you don't need to explain what that is. You know, you're confronted with a situation and you pray, or something draws your mind to something and you pray. And then the prayer is offered during time set apart specifically for prayer, what a later generation of evangelicals would call the quiet time. In response to Thomas's answer, Francis then confesses this. I wish all our brethren in the tribe of Levi were so free from lukewarmness on the one hand and enthusiasm, formality, and superstition on the other as my Jonathan appears to be. I'm too barren in all my prayers. But I think mostly so in closet prayer, that is in set times of prayer. Except at some seasons, which tempts me in some measure to prefer a more constant ejaculatory prayer above a more stately closet prayer, though I'm persuaded neither should be neglected. Ejaculatory prayer is generally warm, free, and pure, though short. But I find closet prayer to be often cold, stiff, and artificial, as it were, and mixed with strange impertinences and wanderings of heart. Lord, teach me to pray. Oh, that I could perform the duty always as a duty and a privilege, and not as a task and a burden. Here Francis begins by emphasizing his concern his prayer life was marked by a zeal that was free from that bugbear of the 18th century, enthusiasm. Nobody wants to be an enthusiast. That means you're a fanatic. He was also concerned that it not be marked by formality, a concern he picks up at the very end of this quotation, where he expresses the hope that his prayers not be a task and a burden. It's interesting, this would be fascinating to tease out. It's interesting, he doesn't want it to be a task and a burden, but it is a duty. And for him, I think for us, the word duty is very negative. I mean, we just don't think in the Christian life about duty. But he doesn't see it that way, obviously. In other words, he's longing for prayer that is warm, free, and pure, that is sincere. His experience of ejaculatory prayer. On the other hand, he confesses he struggles with his regular times of devotion. They're often marred by praying that's cold, stiff, artificial, and they cannot maintain his focus on God. And the reason why that resonates with us is because it's my experience at times, and it's your experience, I suspect, too. It's not a problem unique to Francis. In the previous entry, the open membership Baptist John Bunyan had admitted he too struggled in this regard. Oh, the starting holes the heart hath in time of prayer. None knows how many byways the heart hath and back lanes to slip away from the presence of God. How much pride also if enabled with expressions. How much hypocrisy if before others. And how little conscience is there made of prayer between God and the soul in secret unless the spirit of supplication be there to help. When a little later, Thomas remarked that a believer's great and chief delight, his meat and drink, the life of his life, is his closet prayer and communion with God, we find another honest and humble comment from Francis. How languid my faith, my hope, my love. How cold and formal am I in secret devotions. These remarks surely stem from deep-seated convictions about the vital importance of prayer. No wonder Francis could cry out to his Lord to teach him to pray. And he's not a young, as we'll see now in a minute, he's not a young Christian. And I think the one surprise of my life as a Christian, one of the biggest surprises of my life, is to how little progress I've made, to be honest. I used to look at people who looked like me when I was 20, I think, man, these guys are giants in prayer. Be great when you get to that age and all the struggles I've got will be a thing of the past. And it's disturbing, you know, to think of how little progress in one sense I've made. I'm not speaking for anybody else here. I've got no idea. But but I resonate with Francis at this point. Francis' frank remarks about his own struggles with prayer also have their root in Francis' belief that since the Lord had enabled him to seek Christ at a very young age, he should be more eager to pray out of a sense of gratitude. As he confessed, the more spiritual, divine, and disinterested any duty is, disinterested, that is, without exterior ulterior motives, the more opposition there is in sinful nature to it. I've sometimes wondered at the opposition, or at least disinclination, I find in my wicked heart too often under prayer, as if it were to perform some very painful service, and also the vile excuses that offer me their enchanting couch to rest myself upon. I can follow you and even outstrip you in all your complaints, only that my negligence in this solemn duty may be much more appreciated than any in you, since the Lord, I hope at least, inclined me to seek him very young, and overwhelmed me with joy by a sense of his love. It is but comparatively seldom that I am enabled to pour forth my whole soul to God in prayer according to my desire. A stupid, indolent, sensual, illegal temper sadly clogged the winds of my prayer. True prayer has humility, faith, and love as it for its ingredients, and it is for want of having these graces in their lively exercises, I pray not more frequently, more fervently. Here, too, the specific struggle of prayer was not unique to Francis. Bunyan, in the previous century, admitted to having the same struggle. May I but speak my experience, and from that tell you the difficulty of praying to God as I ought. It's enough to make your poor, blind, carnal man to entertain strange thoughts of me. For as for my heart, when I go to pray, I find it so loath to go to God, and when it is with him, so loath to stay with him, that many times I'm forced in my prayers first to beg God he would take mine heart, and set it on himself in Christ, and when it is there, that he would keep it there. You can see the struggle of prayer and how he'd have to pray that Lord would help him to pray, and help him to stay fixed in his prayers, etc. Thomas sought to encourage Francis by reminding him, closet prayer is like the smoke on a windy day. This is not an illustration that would come regularly to us. We don't have fires normally. When it's very calm, the smoke will ascend and resemble an erect pillar. But when windy, as soon as it's out, it is scattered to and fro. And sometimes these beating down the chimney again and fills the whole house. Shall I not thus give over? Satan would have it so. Flesh would have it so. But I should be more earnest in it. And the experience of having smoke fill the house from the fire is not a pleasant one. Francis told his friend that he sought to pray to God twice daily. So in other words, he has this personal discipline of two times of the devotion. But he confessed his difficulties of following a discipline of a set time for prayer stem from his being away from his home a lot of the time. He's away during the week often preaching. He also admitted he'd taken an unhappy habit of sleeping in the morning much longer than he should have. That probably meant he slept until about 6. I don't know what he would think of me. I'm late to bed, and if I have to, I'm late to rise. For me, often sleeping until 9 or whatever. And they'd be horrified. But and this also cut into valuable time for prayer. But he did not try to excuse such failings. In 1767, Thomas asked of his friend, how may one know whether his prayers are answered or not? Francis has 6 brief answers. By the removal of the evil prayed against, or the reception and enjoyment of the good prayed for. By the peculiar and extraordinary circumstances that may attend the removal of the evil, the reception of the good, as the success of Abraham's servant. That's when he went looking for Rebekah. When one does not receive the blessing prayed for, but receives another, perhaps not thought of by him, yet more seasonable, needful, and useful. When he's assisted by the Spirit to pray in faith and to wrestle with God, his prayer will then be answered, whether he perceives it or no, or whether he lives to see it or no, though he does not receive the particular good he prays for. When God meets with, that is, revives and relieves him in prayer, that is a speedy way in which God answers the prayer of his people. I will not remove thy sore affliction, Paul, that though thou hast entreated me thrice, but thy grace shall be sufficient for thee to bear it. Thus God sometimes answers a prayer with a promise, but not the immediate blessing. In general, one may conclude that God answers his prayers when he is made, that's the person praying, more holy, resigned to the will of God, enabled to persevere in all the duties of religion. Notice that the duties of religion, that's saying so horrible to probably the typical 20th century evangelical mind, but that's standard 18th century language, and I think it tells us something about 18th century writers that we need to bear in mind. There are duties in the Christian life, and Christianity is the true religion. And rejoice in the God of his salvation. The last of these six answers is especially important. It displays the mature realization that four of the most important things for which we could pray for are these: growth in holiness, unreserved commitment to God's sovereign will over one's life, perseverance in the Christian faith, and a heart of joy in God. Much has changed since Francis' day, yet the struggle with sin and poor habits that hinder prayer and devotion remains the same. And yet there must have been times when Francis knew the joys of experiential fellowship with God in prayer. For instance, answering a question by Thomas, "Wherein doth communion and fellowship with God consist?" Francis replies in part, "In a nearness to God that is inexpressible, through the mediator, and in the enjoyment of God's favor and perfections, yielding nourishing satisfactions in God as the soul's full, everlasting portion and felicity. This enjoyment overwhelms the soul with wonder, glory, joy, and triumph. It inflames it with vehement love to God and ardent wishes after his blissful presence in the heavenly world." Yet as Francis well knew, these four tastes of glory given to the believer in prayer are not a resting place in this world. Christ, not the believer's experience of communing with him in prayer, is ever to be the focus of prayer. And as Francis could pray, and this text well reveals the Christ-centered nature of historic Baptist spirituality only a year before his death. "Oh, that every sacrifice I offer were consumed with a fire of ardent love to Christ. Reading, praying, studying, preaching are to me very cold exercises, if not warmed with the love of Christ. This is the quintessence of holiness, of happiness, of heaven. While many professors of Christ, desire to know that Christ loves them, may it ever be my desire to know that I love him by feeling his love, mortifying in me the love of self, animating my whole soul to serve him, and if called by his providence, to suffer even death for his sake."